You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And in a very exotic looking location, Daniel Freeb.
It's not exotic. You make it sound like I'm surrounded by palm trees and bongo drums. It's not. Well, I mean,
it's exactly what you're surrounded by, Daniel. No, mountains, sunshine,
vineyards,
dramatic skies.
Yep.
You're wearing sunglasses. Secret location, is it?
Secret location in Switzerland. Secret neutral location in Switzerland.
Oh, how appropriate. Well, you were on the Dauphiné. You are once again television's Daniel Freeb, and you have just spent a week on the Critérium du Dauphiné, which we're going to talk about a lot in this episode. I mean, the racing was hugely entertaining, lots of intrigue, lots happened, but we're curious to know about how it all worked as well in the current climate with all the restrictions in place. And Lionel, are you preparing to come out next week to Tour de France? Any concerns given the new restrictions in place, the new quarantine?
Napalm's always got concerns.
Well, yeah, it was a silly question, a redundant question there.
I'm relatively relaxed about it. I mean, you know, look how cool, calm and collected I look. Furrowed brow.
What's that vein throbbing on your temple?
Charlie Brownish furrowed brow here. I'm timing the booking of my coronavirus test so that I'm given a green light for the Tour de France, and then I'll be joining you in France, Richard, and we'll be making our way to Nice on the road, won't we?
Wending our way down, a road trip to kick things off.
It's going to be amazing, isn't it? We'll probably record some kind of road trip episode on the way down, won't we?
Got the route plan, chaps, going east. You're going through sort of Champagne and Rhone Valley. What you thinking?
I should think so. Yep. I think we'll it'll be similar in a way to the big trip we took a couple of years ago, Lionel, after the stage that finished on the cobbles in Roubaix, and we headed down to Annecy on that occasion, but going a bit further this time, all the way to Nice, of course. Hopefully a smoother journey than that one. That was awful, that journey, I remember.
We got stuck in loads of traffic jams, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, it was awful.
What, anyway. Generally, Daniel, what was France like? Did it feel quite quiet, or was it sort of business as usual?
It felt quite France-y, Napalm. Pretty much business as usual. A lot of masks being worn. Was there for about a week, so I don't know whether dramatically in the last week the proportion of people in the UK wearing masks has spiked suddenly, but in France pretty much everyone is wearing masks at all times now. They're not obligatory everywhere, as the buff can attest, but it's sort of moving in that direction.
I had an awkward situation last week when I went out on my bike to do a big long training ride for my big ride at the weekend there, and I set off. It was a roasting hot day, mid-30s. Set off with two bottles and some money to buy water en route, and I realised after about an hour that I had not brought a face mask with me and that I wouldn't be able to go into a shop. You just couldn't do it here at all. So I had to cut my ride short because I didn't, you know, it just wasn't an option. It's definitely completely accepted here that you wear a face mask. So we'll be taking supplies of face masks with us, I guess.
As an excuse for cutting a ride short, that is one I've not heard before, but it's an absolute belter.
Trying to avoid dehydration? That seems like a reasonable excuse to me. Anyway, we're going to hear in this episode from Pavel Sivakov, the Russian rider on Team Ineos, who had an eventful Dauphiné. We'll hear a little interview with him, but there is a lot to talk about racing and more crashes, unfortunately, some bad crashes as well. That's been one of the big talking points of the week. Do you have a news roundup for us, please, Lionel?
I do indeed, Rich. We'll start with the second monument of the season, Il Lombardia, and a second monument victory for Astana's Jakob Fuglsang, who won Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year, of course. What an impressive six-man break there was. Three Trek Segafredo riders in it, and they managed to finish fourth, fifth and sixth. Quite a feat, that was. They were outwitted, really, by two Astana riders and one from Jumbo-Visma. It was a showdown between Fuglsang and George Bennett of Jumbo-Visma, who had won the Gran Piemonte in impressive style in the middle of last week, and he was looking to do so again with a number of attacks on the final climb. But when Fuglsang turned on the gas, Bennett didn't really have an answer, and Fuglsang soloed on to the finish to win the race. As you say, it was marred by a couple of incidents, Richard. The first was a serious crash on the descent of the Muro di Sormano for Remco Evenepoel, who, well, it's difficult to tell exactly what happened, but he came to a sudden halt and went over the handlebars and over the side wall.
Well, he was off the back of that break that you know, he was just off the back of that, and I think obviously chasing to get back on.
He was, yeah, and well, he went over the side wall and some way down, rescued and taken to hospital by the ambulance staff, and the reports are that he's fractured his hip. I mean, a week ago he was crossing the line in the Tour of Poland, holding up the race number of his teammate Fabio Jakobsen, who'd been involved in that terrible crash, of course, at the start of the Tour of Poland. And now Evenepoel's season looks to be over. Certainly the Giro d'Italia seems very unlikely for him at this stage. There was also an incident on the run-in, fortunately less serious, but it did leave Max Schachmann with a fractured collarbone. Schachmann was riding in to take seventh place, and a car being driven by a member of the public had got onto the course and turned left across him. You know, something that really shouldn't happen. The UCI is investigating the incident and will presumably take action against the race organisers if they are found to be at fault. The news roundup really isn't long enough to sum up the Critérium du Dauphiné, so I'll just keep it to the headlines for now, because we're going to talk in a lot more detail about the race. But it started brilliantly for Jumbo-Visma. Wout van Aert won the opening stage, Primoz Roglic took the second. There was a hailstorm which literally left its mark on some of the riders. If you saw the photograph of Tim de Klerk's back, the red welts told the story of how severe that hailstorm was. Davide Formolo won stage three on his own with a long break. Egan Bernal of Ineos, who had been challenging overall, didn't start stage four because he had an issue with his back. Emmanuel Buchmann, who was lying third overall, crashed out of the race, as did Jumbo-Visma's Steven Kruiswijk, which has dealt a bit of a blow potentially to their Tour de France preparations. Worse was to come for Jumbo-Visma, because Primoz Roglic also went down. Although he managed to finish that fourth stage, but he didn't start stage five, which meant that the yellow jersey was left vacant, but in the virtual possession of Thibaut Pinot. And then there was an absolutely thrilling final stage, wasn't there? Contested by the class of 2020 and won by Jumbo-Visma's Sepp Kuss. And the overall battle, well, it went down to the line, and Dani Martinez of EF Pro Cycling took it ahead of Thibaut Pinot and Guillaume Martin, who quietly did a very excellent job for Cofidis, which not words that we often hear in the same sentence very often these days. Nairo Quintana also pulled out of the final stage with knee pain, although that is thought to be a precautionary abandon with the Tour de France coming up. Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas each lost over 33 minutes on the final stage. Didn't look particularly convincing all week, but the implications of all that for the Tour de France are about as clear as mud. But one thing I would say is that the shorter Dauphiné, with all the boring bits taken out, did leave us with an absolutely fascinating and very intense race, didn't it? The Tour de Wallonie is underway. An opening stage was won by Caleb Ewan on Lotto Soudal general manager Mark Sargent's birthday. And Richard, your near neighbour Arnaud Demar has just taken stage two a few minutes ago. The World Championships, which are due to be held, or were due to be held in Switzerland a week after the Tour de France, have been cancelled because of the country's rules on which are banning gatherings of over 1,000 people. The UCI is investigating the possibility of holding the race somewhere else in Europe, but there's really not a lot of time to get that organised. And there's been a lot of transfer news. I'll just run through a few that have been confirmed. Mike Woods from EF Pro Cycling to Israel Startup Nation is one. Israel have been very busy because they also look to have signed Carl Frederick Hagen and Daryl Impey, who will be leaving Mitchelton Scott to join Israel Startup Nation. AG2R have also been busy. They've signed Greg Van Avermaet, and Lilian Kalmajan has been confirmed, and it looks like Pierre Latour is going from AG2R to Total Direct Energy. Any other rumours? I think Jack Haig to Bahrain, Adam Yates to Ineos looks like it's, although not confirmed, looks like it's very much happening. Anything else you've heard?
Those are the main ones, Napalm. There are a few sort of teams which are very deliberately not announcing new signings just at the moment. You know, with so much racing going on, they obviously don't want to distract their riders from that. One thing we mentioned a few weeks ago, well, we were talking about AG2R and the fact that they don't have a GC rider, and we sort of threw a few names around of GC riders who might be on the market. We mentioned Pavel Sivakov, and who was a real star in the Dauphiné. I believe that he has already renewed with Ineos, and that was done quite a while ago, but it hasn't been announced yet.
I mean, that's like Lionel Messi joining Watford, surely, at the moment.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our title sponsor, iWalker. Grateful to them for their support. Lionel, I'll get back to you in a moment on your Lionel Messi analogy, because he's quite old. And Pavel Sivakov, Pav, as he seems to be known to Daniel. He's very young.
Siv, not Pav.
Oh, sorry, I meant to say Siv. Yeah, Siv.
Is anyone Pav?
Pav, yeah, Pav sounds a bit like Pog, Rog, Pav. Pog, Rog, Siv.
These nicknames are all as bad as my footballing analogy there. You're right. I literally can't think of a young, world-class footballer. Mine's gone blank. Well, sorry.
Well, there are lots of young world class cyclists. Luckily, we'll talk about a few of them.
Erling Haaland.
There we go.
I hadn't finished my iWalker. Thank you. Thank you, iWalker. If you run a small business and you're interested to find out how iWalker can support you, go to iwalker.co.uk and check out their reviews as well on Trustpilot. They've got very good reviews. And we've been talking to iWalker recently about the good cause that we'll be supporting at the Tour de France through the sale of Stacey Snyder's mugs and cups. And we did ask you as well a while ago for suggestions. We were particularly interested in good causes that promoted diversity in cycling. So we've had a few nominations. We'll be announcing the good cause or good causes next week in next week's episode of the podcast. But in the first part, we're going to, I think, talk about Il Lombardia a bit later on. The Dauphiné will occupy us for the first part of the podcast. I don't really know where to start. I mean, you know, it began the first few days. It was this sort of tantalising Ineos Jumbo Visma power struggle, I suppose. But it ended up, you know, that Ineos were, I guess, the losers in that. But were Jumbo Visma the winners? Because they come out the week licking their wounds as well, their actual wounds, whereas Ineos's wounds are more perhaps psychological wounds, I don't know. But what a crazy few days. And, you know, in terms of setting things up for the tour, I don't really know where we stand.
No, it's a good point, Rich. Who were the winners? Certainly it felt as though it was a trouncing in terms of performance dished out by Jumbo-Visma to Ineos. And, you know, the Dauphiné is usually a bit further away from the Tour de France, usually 3 weeks, or there have been times when it's been 4 weeks. But we always look to the Dauphiné for pointers as to what's going to happen in the Tour. And so close to this Tour de France, only 2 weeks, you know, you were left thinking, is that enough time for Ineos to turn it around? Because there's no doubt they do need to turn it around. And I suppose, you know, we heard murmurs throughout the week, particularly from Ineos riders, about all the very hard block of racing and training that they've done over the last month, and the suggestion that there was this sort of staleness, which you know, it's a well-known sort of physiological phenomenon that after a long and hard block of training, it can take a while for the benefits to be there. I don't know enough about physiology to be confident that you know, Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas in particular will suddenly bounce back in 2 weeks. If there is such a phenomenon, then I don't know exactly the mechanisms of that. Do you, chaps?
No, not really. And what's curious is that, you know, the poor performances are not across the board at Team Ineos. When, you know, if they've all been preparing the same way, and certainly Sivakov has been training a lot with Froome and Thomas for quite a number of weeks now, going back to an altitude camp in the Alps before they went to Tenerife. So they've had similar preparation. He's clearly going pretty well, and they're not. And Kwiatkowski, I thought, was pretty impressive. He looked pretty good. And Bernal, for all that, you know, he pulled out, he's going well, I think. Bernal is not far away and could well be the strongest rider at the Tour. I mean, I look at Jumbo-Visma and, you know, there are echoes in Roglic's form of last year before the Giro, when he went into that race red hot and was a big favourite, but didn't sustain it over the 3 weeks at the Giro. And he came into the Vuelta later in the year, you know, far less raced, more rested perhaps, and kind of rode into that race more. Whereas, as things stand, you know, for all that he pulled out as a precaution, we think, after crashing, he is in incredible form. And, you know, you can imagine a similar scenario at the Tour, where the question will become, can he sustain this over 3 weeks?
Was there any indication, Daniel, from being on the ground at the Dauphiné that Bernal was struggling for the day, a couple of days before he decided not to start stage four?
No, I don't think he was really napalm. I mean, it was well documented. A lot of people saw him out on the course actually riding, training. I don't know how many hours he did, but the day when he pulled out, he did, you know, ride his bike and looked fine. I think he was actually riding on the route that all of the team buses were taking to the finish. So he wasn't going to any great lengths to hide the fact that he was still on his bike. And so I don't think there's too many issues there. I mean, it's just interesting. You look at the, you know, the way the respective teams have built towards the Tour de France, and this decision that Jumbo-Visma took to name their team well in advance, months in advance, and they've made one change. So Laurens de Ploos came out and has been replaced by George Bennett. But, you know, they've known the team for a long time. And it occurred to me during the Dauphiné that could have worked against the healthy competition that you often get in the lead-up to the Tour. And, you know, it's always beneficial to have 10 riders who are in great form battling for 8 places. But the solidity is the other side of the coin, and the certainty that they've had. And, you know, they look a very, very confident bunch at the moment. And the coaches and the physiologists there seem to have done a fantastic job in getting them all. I mean, Rich, you said Roglic seems to be on absolutely fantastic form, blistering form, but the whole team...
including, they're purring, aren't they?
Yeah, including George Bennett in Italy, Sepp Kuss we saw win the stage on Sunday, and
Wout van Aert is going okay.
Well, Wout van Aert's going like 3 riders at the moment. I mean,
Tony Martin looks good as well.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing which will be interesting to see, obviously, Kruijswijk dislocated his shoulder on Saturday, and you would think that would jeopardise his presence in the Tour. I think the prognosis for dislocated shoulders can vary hugely, and it's not beyond the realms of possibility that he could start. But if he doesn't, one thing that I think we talked about last week was that Jumbo-Visma have got a lot of specialists in their team. They've got climbers or rouleurs, really. I mean, Wout van Aert, again, was fantastic on every train. One thing they might decide to do if Kruijswijk is not available for the Tour is they might decide that indeed they do have too many climbers, and the climbers that they do have are going so well that actually they can rebalance the team slightly with it. Maybe an experienced rouleur. That was something that the Dutch journalist present at the Dauphiné suggested may happen, someone like a Jos van Emden. Otherwise, I think maybe Antoine Tolhoek could come in as more of a like-for-like replacement for Kruijswijk. The other thing that was interesting was that they all talked all of their riders at the Dauphiné talked about the danger of being too greedy and almost being overexcited at times. There were a couple of, well, there was the day when Formula One in particular, when they chased quite hard behind trying to pick up yet another stage win, and they burned off Kreiswijk and Dumoulin, who were, I think, pretty frustrated with that afterwards, and said as much to the press. And there was a bit of sort of cannibalism in the old sense that people used to associate with Eddie Merckx, that they wanted to win absolutely everything and they didn't need to do that.
Can I just say briefly on dislocated shoulders? Cameron Meyer dislocates his shoulder quite regularly and just puts it back in by the side of the road. He's done it in races and carried on. But I think it depends on whether that's something you've done before. I think it depends on whether
you make it sound like it's a favourite pastime.
No. But it sounds like one of the most painful things you can do. But yeah, he's prone, or was prone to it.
Before Roglic pulled out of the race, wasn't there a slight concern, Rich? We talked about it a couple of days into the race, that maybe the same mistakes were being made as were made before the Giro last year, where he came into the race so strong, having just won the Tour of Romandy, and then faded at the crucial moment in the final, well, it wasn't even the final week, was it? It was the penultimate weekend. So basically 2 weeks into the race and things were sort of unravelling for him a little bit. I mean, there is no sense in winning all the pre-season friendlies and then not being where you need to be when the real stuff starts. And I think you just think back to the Tour de France last year and how we almost all ruled out Ineos, didn't we? And then Bernal was just there kind of waiting, and the move that won the race happened on the third day from the end. And I just wonder whether Jumbo-Visma are aware of, you know, being a bit too hot now. It's still 2 weeks till the start, 4 or 5 weeks until the Tour de France will be decided. So yeah, it was an interesting to hear you talking about them wanting to really sort of turn the screw and dominate. I mean, if it turned out slightly differently, you could imagine them winning all five stages with perhaps two or three different riders. I mean, well, they won three stages with three different riders. It was enough, really. So it's going to be interesting. And I wonder, I mean, Roglic not finishing the race, I mean, didn't need to. I'm assuming that his injuries aren't serious enough to put his Tour de France in any jeopardy whatsoever. But, that was a precautionary thing rather than just going on and clinching the overall in the Dauphiné. In the grand scheme of things, doesn't really matter to them, I guess.
And the other thing that we expected the week to do was maybe solve the Chris Froome problem, or at least kind of elucidate what Ineos were likely to do in terms of selecting him, not selecting him. He was on a sort of upward trajectory after Route Occitanie and then the Tour de l'Ain. He looked pretty good in the Tour de l'Ain. And we didn't get to speak to Chris Froome very much at the Dauphiné. I think he doesn't really want to partake in any of the speculation that's going on at the moment about whether he will or he won't ride the Tour, whether he'll be some kind of leader at the Tour. So we only spoke to him, I think, on one occasion, and there was another day when he sort of found himself leaning against a barrier and we were very close by and we could ask him one or two questions. But my impression was that the last 2 days were really disappointing, both for Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome. I think Froome would have liked to be in the break on the last day. And I think, you know, as soon as the leaders started attacking each other early in the stage, then all hopes that riders further down general classification had of getting in the break sort of went up in smoke. And Froome ended the week a pretty sort of forlorn figure, well down the general classification.
It's hard. Yeah, I mean, he almost looked better at Occitanie a couple of weeks ago. I mean, albeit in a much weaker field, but it's hard to imagine really him in particular, but Geraint Thomas too there weren't many signs from either of them that they were going to be a force at the Tour de France.
No, there weren't, Rich. I believe that Ineos expect to at least, if not publicly name their tour team, then at least come up with their eight names internally today. So today's Monday or Tuesday, so early this week anyway. And at this point, I really don't know. Again, it will come down to what the physiologists and what people like Tim Kerris and the coaches know about the work that the likes of Freeman, well, we expect Thomas to be selected. But, you know, Tim Kerris will know what work Freeman's done, and he'll know how he expects him to react to that work, and whether there's a lag of a week or two, and, you know, suddenly in 10 days' time he feels great and fresh, I don't know.
I mean, there's such a thing as, you know, the bluff to con and kid the opposition, but I mean, this is almost a quadruple bluff, isn't it? It's who are they bluffing themselves as much as the opposition? I mean, it's impossible to say, isn't it? But as you say, Daniel, the team selection will tell us exactly what the team management think. And my bet now, if I had to. I mean, I don't like this sort of speculation, but I'm starting to think Chris Froome won't be on the start line in Nice, which I think is might be a bit of a shame.
But at the end of it all, as you know, the Trek Segafredo illustrated in Il Lombardia, it doesn't matter if you've got the numbers or the strongest team if you've not got the strongest rider. And Bernal could still be the strongest rider at the Tour. It's very, very, very feasible.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, of course, interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it's supported by Lacca. Lacca's collective cover is made especially for cyclists for life on and off your bike. Lacca has flipped outdated traditional insurance on its head with no more fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims that month. Your maximum monthly price is capped, but the savings are all yours. Plus, 80% of your money goes straight back into the collective, fixing, replacing and helping. The other 20% keeps Lacca's wheels spinning. It's as simple as that. And when things go bad, Lacca's got your back. Claims are handled by experts and usually agreed within a day, with no depreciation or excess. They've ditched annual contracts locking you in. With Lacca, if you want to leave, you can anytime. If you head over to www.lacca.co, new customers can get £10 credit by signing up today with the discount code podcast. That's lacca.co, LACA.co. And for the rest of 2020, you can join the Lacca Club for just £1. Get third-party liability cover plus stacks of cycling discounts from Komoot, Sports Pursuit and many more. You needn't be a Lacca bike policyholder to join the Lacca Club either. Anyone can join, from weekend club riders to the everyday commuter. It's not a nice thing to think about, but third-party insurance could really save your bacon. If you were involved in an incident with a pedestrian, motorist or cyclist while out on the road, you could end up being sued to fork out for court costs, medical costs, loss of earnings and lots of other nasty surprises. With £2 million worth of coverage, it's in these exact circumstances where Lacca's third-party liability cover is designed to protect you. Take out the £1 offer today by heading to lacca.co/club. That's lacca.co/club.
This episode is also sponsored by Harry's. Now, Richard, you've been a Harry's Razors customer for a long while. We're only a week or so away from packing for the Tour. Have you got your Harry's Razor set in your wash bag ready to take with you?
Oh, well, packing, there's a thought, Lionel. It's a while since I've done any packing at all, other than to move house. But packing a bag to go away for a few weeks, that's going to be a novel experience. And my Harry's razors with spare blades will be in my wash bag. I've been using them ever since Harry's began advertising in our podcast, which has been a good few years now. And we're grateful to them because it helps to support what we do.
So what do you get with the Harry's trial set, which all of our listeners can get for £3.95?
You get the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel and the travel blade cover. By going to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling. Well, chaps, as we all know, Daniel's hugely influential. I've copied one of his most popular ideas, his lists of 18 riders. I've got 18 riders who had a bad week and 18 riders who had a good week. I partly did this because I was sort of struggling to get my head around all the various permutations from the races and what was going on. So I tried to simplify it for myself, and in doing so made it far more complicated, obviously. So 18 riders who had a bad week. Well, the crash victims, Evenepoel, Schachmann, Buchmann, Kreuzwick, Rog, Thomas, Froome, Bernal, Nairo Mann, Enric Mas, Valverde, Landa, Adam Yates, Cavendish, Lopez, Nibali, Mollema, Ciccone. and
Lopez, as yeah, in Superman.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, sorry, Superman, sorry. I got his name wrong. And 18 riders who had a good week. Fuglsang, Bennett, Van Aert, Sivakov, Kuss, Dumoulin, Pinot, Martinez, Kamna, Guillaume Martin, Formolo, Ewan, Vlasov, Kwiatkowski, Bardet, Barguil, Carapaz, and Theo Gegenhardt, who didn't race. But yeah, I mean, one name that popped out for me there in riders who had a good week, Tom Dumoulin. You know, he is coming from not a similar point to Chris Froome, but he did miss a similar amount of racing through injury and then illness. And he wasn't setting the heather on fire, perhaps, but he rode solidly, I thought, and strongly, and did enough to suggest that, you know, he probably has a margin for improvement as well, and that he could be quite a force at the Tour.
Yeah, he looked very good on that. Looked very good on that final climb on Sunday, didn't he? Daniel, did you talk to him over the week?
Yes, quite a lot. He was in good, sort of expansive, illuminating form as usual. Yesterday, he said that it felt really this week like the first time he was back in the mix as a GC rider, and that his career had finally sort of picked up where it came to an abrupt halt a couple of years ago with that crash in the Giro, wasn't it, really, when he injured his knee and then had assorted problems after that. So yeah, I think he is he's very much on the up, 2 weeks away from the Tour. And you know, I think his concern for part of this week was that they needed, and they will need at the Tour, to keep him close to wherever Roglic is leading general classification, or well up the general classification, then in order for the two-man or three-man, hopefully, if Kreuzwijk is there, attack to be effective, they need to, you know, they can't be blowing up and sitting up having done the last pull for Roglic on climbs.
And Pino was in my good week list, but he, we read today, has a back problem too, and won't be riding the French Nationals. But overall, I think he had a good week. I wonder if he'd have won that race had he not been in the virtual yellow jersey, because even though he wasn't wearing the actual yellow jersey, the pressure of that seemed to count against him and made him the target. And, you know, Martinez almost slipped up the road unnoticed in a way, whereas all eyes were on Pino, and you could just sense Pino getting frustrated and angry, and he was isolated, which was disappointing. I'm sure Reichenbach was his last teammate. They didn't have all their big guns there, Groupama, FDJ, but yeah, Pino, I watched that and thought, if Pino's going to win the Tour, he'll have to take the yellow jersey at La Planche des Belles Filles, I think.
That's exactly what a lot of people are saying, Rich. I had this conversation with a number of people over the weekend, and you know, the way he reacted yesterday, it was a bit emotional. You could see it on TV, and even after the stage, he admitted that he became completely demoralised at a certain point when Dani Martinez and Superman and Sepp Kuss attacked. And as you say, he was missing Rudy Mollard, he was missing David Gourdou, who were two sort of key mountain domestiques. But you do wonder whether, when if he is put in a position of leading the race, or he's the man in possession, whether he will be able to sort of defend it and the team will be able to defend it with the necessary sort of sang-froid, because they've never really done it before. They haven't had the experience, and Pino, it doesn't come naturally to Pino. That was one thing that was discussed yesterday, the fact that it was a valuable experience, because they haven't been in that position very often to have a sort of target on their back, and they didn't really, well, they failed really in very difficult circumstances, attacks from, you know, almost kilometre zero. He had sort of team leaders flying left, right, And he had to follow all of those attacks. But yeah, a little bit worrying, I would say. The one doubt you don't have with Pino is that he's physically strong enough and able enough on his best days.
Yeah, Richard used the word frustrated. He did look frustrated, but it was such an erratic effort by him, wasn't it? I mean, especially once he was on his own and had no teammates to look around. I mean, he was kind of quick, slow, wasn't he? You know, trying to chisel time out and maybe crack the morale of the riders ahead. But I don't really know what he was doing. He would have been far better off riding much more in a much more boring way, just a hard pace on his own at the front. You know, rather than sort of going into the red and settling back, going. And that's his brain letting him down a bit, rather than his legs letting him down, I would say.
And this is why people love him.
Absolutely.
This is why people...
Yeah, that vulnerability. I mean, he was a moment where he went off the front on his own, and he kept looking behind. The race was up the road, and what was happening behind him was of no concern to him whatsoever.
And then
kept looking behind.
And then Romain Bardet was up the road as well, almost trolling Pino, and it was almost as if that was getting in his head as well. I mean, I think, Daniel, you said sang-froid, exactly that, just the sort of the cold-bloodedness of what do I need to do to chisel back these 29 seconds. I mean, it was so close at times. He could have, with a clearer effort and a much kind of calmer strategy, he could have done it, but...
He should have done it,
but like you say, maybe that is an important day when it comes to the Tour de France. You know, if a similar scenario presents itself, you know, to react to it slightly differently. But I mean, he was up against it. I mean, that was a heck of a, you know, as I called it, the class of 2020. I mean, there was a lot of power in that leading group, and very dynamic, everyone with something to gain, you know, young riders looking for big wins, you know, in the case of Dani Martinez, the biggest win of his career, you know, Sepp Kuss off the leash. I mean, there was a lot of legs up the road, to be fair to Pino.
But just on that effort, chaps, how many times have we maligned but also had to sort of doff our cap to riders who've produced those very steady, consistent efforts over the last few years. You know, you think of the Chris Froome ride to Bardonecchia, wasn't it? Mm. That won the Giro, and everything we've know and has been said about that ride since then suggests that the real cornerstone of it was the ability to maintain a consistent sort of wattage pace. And also consistent kind of mental attitude through the whole thing. I think of other similar rides. I think of Cadel Evans in the Tour de France in 2011 on the Galibier, where he just, you know, he was completely unfazed by what was going on up the road. And, you know, Pino needs to develop that maybe to win more important races and to achieve his ultimate goal of winning the Tour. But... not to win hearts, because he already does that.
Well, no, he contributed fantastically to a spectacle. He didn't win the race, but it was you couldn't take your eyes off him when the camera cut back to the group that he was in. And like you say, Rich, I mean, when he was off up the road, I was thinking this is not the way to win the race here. You need to maybe have a word with somebody else in the group and see if anyone is prepared to try and bring it in. Because like I say, the gap was half a minute, really, and somebody in that group would have been tempted with the idea of a potential stage win. There were enough people in there to maybe put together a bit of an alliance. But there you go.
As cyclists of yore would scandalously, scurrilously have said, it was time to get his wallet out.
Get the checkbook out. Did Pavel Sivakov win it for Dani Martinez? Is the question, because he was a powerful engine in that group.
And Pog. To a certain extent, Siv and Pog. You can't go wrong with Siv and Pog.
I was going to ask you about Pog. I mean, Pog. I was swithering with whether to put him in good week or bad week. I ended up with a so-so category, which had Pog and Matthew van der Poel in it,
and 150 other riders in it.
I thought you were a bit unfair to Superman. I thought he had a good week, and he's in the bad week. And Kwiatkowski, you put in the good week. I thought he would be in the sort of so-so week.
On Superman, I mean, he had the race in his pocket at one point, and then what happened? I mean, he got his...
Well, I actually struggled to find 18 who had a good week. 18 had a bad week was quite easy. Superman, I just don't think he's kicked on. You know, I don't think he has developed in the way that we thought he might develop.
He hasn't, but I think he's quite consistent, and I think he's quite robust, and he tends to be, you know, a bit like Nigel Mann. He tends to, you know, ride well in the third week of Grand Tours, and okay, you know, I think Astana, well, obviously, ideally, they would like him to be winning Grand Tours, but he's always a good bet for fourth, fifth, sixth place, and I just think that he was a lot better than there was a, in his case, there's a clear improvement from the first races after lockdown, so I thought that was an encouraging sign.
But what happened to him? I mean, at one point it looked like it was going to be between him and Martinez, two Colombians going head to head, and then you looked away and it was as if Lopez had got his cape caught in his spokes and was like 2 minutes back.
You can't just decide to win the race, Nathan.
Is that not how it works?
No.
Well, one man who did do some quite good deciding to win the race was Danny Martinez. I mean, impressive. Very impressive when the pressure was on. You know, he took the reins, didn't he, when he could have just sat in the wheels. When he knew he had to gain seconds, he was on the front, he was pushing the pace, thoroughly deserved to take that victory. And, well, EF Pro Cycling... I've kind of been saying, well, that's the cover blown. Will Danny Martinez be a figure in the Tour de France? I mean, he's just,
well,
if we're talking about Pogacar, I mean, surely we've got to talk about Martinez. I mean, he's just won a race ahead of him.
I don't know much about him, and I struggle to separate him and Sergio Higuita in terms of their qualities. Higuita's smaller, he had a crash, obviously, but Who's higher rated, Daniel?
Oh, I think Martinez is much more of a GC, a sort of thoroughbred GC type rider, and has been talked about in those terms for a number of years. But he's also been overshadowed, I would say, by other emerging Colombians, Superman and Bernal in particular. And he's also, and there have been a couple of occasions when he's looked to be on the brink of a big breakthrough, and whether due to crashes or illness, it just hasn't quite happened for him. And sometimes you've been left wondering whether the hype, well, certainly the esteem in which he's held at EF has exceeded his actual ability. But yesterday has given lie to that. Very cool. He was very strong. And actually, you know, if I'd listened more closely, I spoke to him at the start yesterday, so before his race winning ride, and spoke to a number of riders, and a lot of them talked about tiredness, and he actually said yesterday morning, I feel great, I'm really happy, you know, with the way the week has gone. And he looked to be relishing the week, so it'll be interesting to see how he fares at the Tour de France. I mean, there are definitely more, well, hype names who are expected to contend for the white jersey. Certainly, you know, you would expect Bernal to be the hot favourite for that, and Pog, as we said, but Martinez has thrown his hat in the ring, hasn't he?
It's one of the advantages that he's not a bad time trialist. I know he's a double back-to-back Colombian time trial champion, but I'm just looking back at last year's Vuelta, for example. He was 10th in the time trial that finished in Po, which is, you know, on paper, not a bad result. Just looking at some of the riders who beat him, I mean, where was he? So 1 minute 28 down on Roglic, who won that stage. Well, I mean, that, yeah,
that's pretty good.
Not bad. I mean, it's you know, 32 seconds quicker than Superman in the time trial. So. Must be an outsider for the Tour de France based on the week's work. And what about Guillaume Martin as well? I mean, a flippant comment about a Cofidis rider doing well in the Dauphiné. It's been a while since they've been on the podium. I wonder if we, before the end of the episode, we can recall who the last Cofidis rider on the podium at the Dauphiné was. I'll look it up.
David Millar. David Millar.
It would be, wouldn't it?
2003.
Yeah. It is, isn't it? Yeah. There we are.
Although was David disqualified from that?
Well, he stood on the podium at the end of that Dauphiné, but then...
Yeah.
Then, who knows? But he was going well, quietly going very well. And, you know, maybe give Cofidis some interest in the mountain stages in the Tour.
Yeah, Guillaume Martin has kind of been... sort of reduced to this caricature by virtue of, well, what's well now a well-documented interest in philosophy and the fact that he's a bit of an intellectual, and the media has tended to stress that, and sometimes it's been at the expense of, you know, his riding, or the recognition that his riding should have been getting, because he's been pretty consistent the last few years. And he's also been quite aggressive. You know, not that many of the attacks have succeeded in big races in mountain stages, but he's not someone who just sucks wheels. And I think Cedric Vasseur took over at Cofidis a couple of years ago now, and slowly, quietly, they're changing the image of that team, and you know, it's looking like a much more serious, well managed outfit.
He has in the past been more aggressive, and it was almost like he was riding the Dauphiné trying something different. He rode a more sort of conservative GC type of race, and it looked to me like he was slipping out of the podium spot you know, when he was stuck with Pino. And you know, perhaps he and Pino should have combined a bit more effectively there, because you know, Pino was pushing hard and then getting frustrated and giving up, and they were slowing down, and Martin was sort of didn't seem to be pulling his weight so much there. I don't know, if we didn't see everything, of course, that was just my impression. I had the feeling he was hanging on. Another quite near neighbor of mine here, he's his family have a farm in Normandy, about 2 hours away from here, so maybe I'll go and try and get some of his Strava King of the Mountains.
Just on that, Rich.
In that neck of the woods.
It's not a great look, though, is it, for a French rider on a French team to help another French rider on another French team win the Dauphiné? I mean, that might not go down too well with the boss.
Although Pino yesterday after the stage did, he did remark that both Wawa, the whimsical flâneur, Warren Barguil, and Julien Alaphilippe were both sort of encouraging him. And again, it kind of, he's, by emphasising how important that was and how great that was for him, it sort of makes you doubt Thibaut's, Pinot's sort of mental robustness even more, you know, that
it was Alaphilippe, wasn't it, who seemed to really make the difference. As you imagine Alaphilippe to do, he's a sort of, he would be a great teammate for Pino. Pino needs a bit of what Alaphilippe has, that kind of swashbuckling confidence and can-do attitude. And it was when Alaphilippe came back to that group and really injected some pace into it that you know, and handed the baton over to Pino, that the gap began to close, and Pino seemed to have a bit more belief in himself. He needs people like that around him, I think.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their long-standing and continued support of the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful to them. And you can still get 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. I took a delivery last week of a big consignment of Science in Sport products, because I'm doing a lot of bike riding out here, and I had my big bike ride.
You've not mentioned that before.
I think I have mentioned it once. I'm fishing for questions, but I mean, you know, I'm obviously going to carry on.
How was your fishing. Big bike ride, Richard?
Oh, thank you, Lionel. it went well. Thank you. Thoroughly enjoyed it, and didn't find the distance too hard. It was 100 miles to 160 kilometers. 166 kilometers to be precise. Really enjoyed it. I mean, no big hills, but just rolling roads, surprised myself. I did, because the last time I rode 100 miles, well, when I did a ride of about 145 kilometers about 5 weeks ago, the last 25 kilometers, my legs were all kinds of shapes from cramp, and I was in real difficulty. And I expected that again, and it didn't happen. So it was good. It was fun. Enjoyed it. Have you been riding, Lionel?
Yep.
You're looking very...
I have been riding a bit, Rich. And my Science and Sport arrived at the end of last week. I don't know, it must have got delayed in the post. So looking forward to taking some out with me when the rain here stops.
Mm. I'm going to do a big bike ride tomorrow. Big old climb in the Jura. Yeah.
Wow.
Got access to a lovely BMC mountain bike here. And I'm going to hit some trails.
Wow. Well, one of the riders who we've mentioned already, Pavel Sivakov, We're going to hear from him in a moment. We will talk about Lombardia after that. But Pavel Sivakov is the Russian rider who was born in Italy, raised in France. His parents were both successful bike riders. And he's a real emerging prospect. I spoke to him just before the Dauphiné. We've had him on the podcast before, but we're hopefully going to hear a lot more from him during the Tour de France. So I thought we'd introduce him properly to you. And he had an eventful race, didn't he, Daniel? It looked like he was a sort of number two behind Bernal, the last man for him in the mountains. And then, of course, he was in that breakaway with Julian Alaphilippe on the final day. He crashed heavily on the descent. His back wheel seemed to slip on a white line, it looked like. He just avoided going over the bars, but came down very heavily. His head clattered against the road, and he got up very quickly and back and caught Alaphilippe, and then sort of emerged in the group that came up from behind as one of the strongest riders in that group and kept attacking. It was a pretty remarkable performance.
Yes, Rich. And we spoke a few weeks ago, didn't we, about the fact that you know, there's always talk about Froome, Bernal and Thomas, but Sivakov, if you look at, you know, what he did last year in the Giro and you look at his age, he is someone who could potentially have been on the brink of a major breakthrough. And, you know, not to say that it's going to be like Froome and Wiggins in 2012, where Froome came into the Tour de France as very much a deputy, and he ended up, well, similar to Bernal a couple of years ago, actually at the Tour. But we thought that it wasn't beyond the realms of possibility that Sivakov could produce something along those lines. And he's certainly very physically talented. He's got it all, really. You know, there's only one time trial in this year's Tour, but the mountain time trial on the penultimate day, but he's someone who's got potential in time trials. He's a really good climber. He's aggressive. I thought, you know, he showed great attitude yesterday when he crashed and got straight back up and, you know, carried on with what he was doing before, i.e. trying to win the stage, which was, I thought, was very impressive.
Hi, Richard.
Hey, Pavel, how are you?
Good, and you?
I've heard sort of reports from in the team about how well you've been going. You know, how did you approach the sort of lockdown period? I guess there was a period of time when you were stuck inside, was there, in Andorra?
Yeah, so it was quite a long period, actually. I think it was, I don't remember how many weeks, but probably close to 2 months. I mean, everyone was locked down at that point. Most of everyone, like in Europe, there were some countries where people were allowed to ride outside. But yeah, I was on the kicker. I did a lot of training on the kicker, indoors, on Zwift, a lot of hours there. It wasn't easy, but yeah, I'm actually quite happy that I think it paid off. I mean, I did some good work there. Then obviously I managed well to rest before to restart on the road, because I could have also, in that part, you know, it's easy to overcook yourself, like especially mentally, because it's not easy riding indoors mentally. But I took a bit of 2 weeks quite easy before to restart on the road, and then went out on the road and was like like a fresh start, new start. I went back to France for a bit, at my family's place, my mom's place, where I used to train, like, before I moved to Andorra. And it was nice to get back on these roads where I grew up and bring back some nice memories. It was like a kind of a fresh start there.
Where is that? Is that down in the southwest of France?
Yeah, so it's not so far from Andorra. It's 180k from there. It's around Saint-Gaudens. We actually started the third stage of Occitanie there. So I was like on my home roads. I knew the stage from start to finish. I was actually training on these roads for forever. So that was great as well. I was motivated on that stage. Was good to be back racing as well.
And yeah, I mean, when you went off, I guess, you know, when you start riding with other people again, you find out, you know, if what you've been doing has worked. Was that what it felt like when you went out to, I don't know, was it Tenerife, the first time you kind of rode a lot with other people?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, when you're on your own, you don't know, okay, there is numbers that shows you something, which is good now, you know, with all the data we have, we can know how well we are going. But you're still, like, in an unknown, like, even like, later. Yeah, I went to Isola first, where we were five guys up in Isola. So it was me, G, Frumi, Kiato, and Dylan. Before to go to Tenerife, we had a good training camp there. So it was the first one, and yeah, it was great to see that, you know, all the work that I did at home paid off. So yeah, obviously I trained pretty hard, and yeah, it paid off, and it's always good. And then, you know, even then, maybe you're going well at training, but then racing is another thing. So you're also in an unknown, because it's one thing going well at training, but that's not what you want. You want to be good on racing.
Yeah, and are you, how confident are you about being selected for the tour? There's obviously a lot of speculation, but you're one of the names that's been suggested as being a very likely to be in the team. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I showed in Occitanie that I was ready to be in the tour team. Of course, if everything goes well, I hope to be in. But you never know, you know, until you're there at the start, I cannot say that I'll be selected. It's like, yeah, every day, you know, you have to confirm, to prove. We've got a really, really strong team as well. So, yeah, I mean, if everything goes well, I hope so.
What do you think about that? I mean, you know, you're still a young rider, the Tour de France is what young riders dream of doing. Do you think about it in those terms, or, you know, going with a team like Team Ineos trying to win it, is it just a job that you have to do? I mean, how much of it, you know, how much does it sort of occupy your dreams still?
Yeah, it's a bit the two things. Of course, it's a dream, but now, you know, when you're into it, when you're in the action, you don't really realize. But then when you sit down and you think a bit about it, you're like, wow, like a couple of years ago, I wouldn't even think about it. And now I'm here trying, yeah, probably going to the tour. And yeah, it's kind of a dream, the Tour de France, especially I grew up in France, and I've always seen that. That race every summer was always like, you know, it's like a party. So yeah, it's amazing, of course, but then it's also kind of part of the job. And I love, yeah, it's, I wouldn't say exactly job, because it's something, you know, like your passion. Of course, it's a job, but also I love doing what I do. And it's kind of, yeah, we're going there, we're going to try to win. And you know, that competitive mindset is also there to be at the best, and really being really focused on all the details leading up to it, nutrition, training, recovery, everything, racing. Yeah, it's all of it, I think, mixed up. And yeah, just exciting. Just have to be calm and not stress too much. Just do what I need to do. I mean, now, yeah, just do what I need to do, and we'll see what happened.
Do you remember the first time you saw the tour? Because I'm guessing you would have seen it a few times down where you grew up.
Yeah, so first time I saw the tour, I don't remember, because I was, yeah, a bit too young to remember, to
well,
be honest.
Your dad last rode it in 2001, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. I must have seen it already the first year he rode it. I think it was 98. If 98 is the year Pantani won, right?
Yeah.
So I think it was 98. Probably we went to see him on the tour there, but I was too young to remember.
You'd have been a baby, I guess.
Yeah, I was one. Yeah. So no, I don't remember going to the tour. At that early age, when my dad was racing. I've got good memories of a stage. I was already older when we went to see the teams at the start. It was in Le Grand Bornand. I think that day Gardeman won a stage. Mm. Don't remember. It was in the early 2000.
2007, I think.
Probably, yeah. And yeah, you know, I was already old enough to realize what was going on around. all the buses and everything, and it was just, yeah, I was just amazed. I was like, wow, this is really nice. Like, the guys, they get to change, like, all the support they get, all the buses, the cars, the bikes and everything. I still have some photos somewhere. I think it was with Borushovs at the time. He was Norwegian champion with Denis Menchov as well. And yeah, that's I've got these memories in mind. And then obviously when I was already racing, I remember actually being, you know, with the local club in Saint-Gaudens. We were at the start of stage starting in Saint-Gaudens, finishing in Plateau de Bay. We're like standing there on the podium, and we did the final 5Ks of the race with the caravan. So yeah, I've got quite a lot of memories. It's really nice, you know. It's like how I really realized how big is that race, not from the inside but from the outside. I think being inside is still another thing you realize even more. But yeah, I've got a lot of memories with the tour every summer, you know, watching the TV, always have something to look forward in the afternoon.
What did you think of Jumbo Visma? I mean, did you think, wow, they're going to be tough opponents at the tour?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I thought, wow, this is they're really going for it this year. Lotto Jumbo, but you know, you don't need to. Yeah, it's good for the sport when you have like a lot more teams, you know, going for it. It's just elevating everyone. And no, I think it's good to see. I mean, tour is still not like tomorrow or the day after. You know, you still have some time. And yeah, I think it keeps everyone motivated, and I'm pretty confident we'll be there, and we will fight for the win, that's for sure. We've got the team for it. Maybe that during that race we can say that they were probably stronger than us, that's for sure. But no, I'm pretty confident it will be a different story in the tour.
So that was Pavel Sivakov. As I said, hope to hear more from him during the Tour de France, assuming he's selected, which I think is a fairly safe assumption.
Are we? You're one of the first names on the team sheet, I think.
Oh yeah.
Are we calling him? Are you guys calling him Pav or Siv?
Siv.
Or are you going to go with his nickname from his teammates, as revealed on another podcast?
Has it been revealed?
It's been revealed, I think, on What's Occurring, that the Ineos riders call him Putin, which, I mean, is pretty imaginative stuff, isn't it?
It's quite funny, I guess.
Wouldn't expect anything else from the sports team.
We're not going to call him that. His nationality is one of the things that's quite interesting about him, isn't it? That, you know, the French have shown little interest so far, but they could get quite interested. And well, we've already started the Civ for AG2R campaign a couple of weeks ago on this podcast. But anyway, on to Lombardy. And it was a race that was overshadowed, I think, by the terrible crash by Remco Evenepoel. Also then by the crash involving Max Schachmann as well. You know, both, it shouldn't matter, you know, who the riders were or what kind of form they were in, but it just so happens that, you know, Evenepoel has been absolutely on fire, Schachmann too, and both had big goals remaining this season, which they may now not be able to try and fulfil. That's sad, but when we saw the Evenepoel incident and, you know, initially the bike leaning against the bridge and the fear that he'd plunged over the other side, you feared, you know, all kinds of awful things, and it sounds as though he got away relatively lightly at this stage, you know, as far as we know, in terms of injuries that he suffered. It could have been awful, and it's, I don't know if it's one of those crashes where we can point to problems with the course or marshalling or anything. It's a feature of that region, isn't it? I mean, the roads are dangerous. They're narrow, they're twisty, they're up and down. And Vincenzo Nibali is the sort of master at being in one of these small groups and really putting the pressure on these descents. And it looked to me, as I said earlier, that Evenepoel was just off the back of that group and taking risks to try and get back on, and, you know, overshot that corner, hit the wall and went over. And it was awful. And we hope for the best for him.
Daniel, do you know much about that descent? Because 3 years ago there were a couple of incidents on it, not in the same position as where Evenepoel had his accident, but who were the riders who went down? Jan Bakkelants was one, wasn't he? And Laurens de Ploos was the other one. The de Ploos one was captured by the TV covering the race that day and was a bad crash. But it is, as Richard says, it is a nature of that region, isn't it? And it comes at a point in the race when the pressure is really, really on. That descent is of key strategic importance, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, Napalm. I mean, it's dangerous. We all know it's dangerous. Evenepoel, you know, he's obviously a very young rider, and it's easy to forget that he's quite an inexperienced rider as well in terms of just the number of years he's been riding a bike, racing a bike, 3 or 4 years. But I haven't heard anyone really suggest thus far that bike handling is a weakness that he has. I think an even more alarming incident, though, chaps, was the Schachmann one. Quite what that car was doing on the course, I don't know. And, you know, not at the end of the race either, not at the back end of the race. I mean, one thing about Lombardy that struck me immediately, I didn't watch it live, was the extraordinary time gaps, which just underlined how, well, we know it's a hard course, we know it's a hard race, but with the August weather as well, it was really brutal. And I guess the peloton would have been strung out over what, half an hour, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, I don't know whether that's any, well, it's not any kind of mitigation, but whether marshals thought they had more time than they actually did to, you know, let someone drive across the course or, you know, exit their driveway. I don't know exactly what happened. But, you know, it was interesting at the weekend that Richard Plugger, the Jumbo-Visma team manager, is suggesting that some kind of private organisation is going to be formed, which will overarch the UCI and also race organisers themselves, and there'll have to be some kind of formal agreement. Whereby this organisation, whether it's manned by former riders or someone else, they want to take the issue of course safety and course approval out of the race organisers and the UCI's hands.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we were kind of talking about that last week, weren't we, in the light of the incident in the Tour of Poland, the need for a standardisation of circumstances across every country in every race. And it does make sense for there to be some kind of body that takes responsibility for that, that the riders have some sort of say and stake in. Before we talk about the race itself in Italy, Daniel, there was a small rider protest at the Dauphiné, wasn't there, about this issue of safety. What actually happened?
Well, the two crashes that occurred on Saturday, so Buchmann and Kreiswijk both crashed out of the race, they both crashed out of the race on the descent of the Plombois, the climb is called, the descent is called. And this generated a lot of discussion. Tom Dumoulin said it was disgrace that that descent was in the race. Thibaut Pinot said that he trained on it a couple of weeks ago and assumed that it would be resurfaced, that it was maybe adequate for a mountain bike but not for a road bike, and it hadn't been resurfaced. I do also know, though, that, well, certainly ASO said after the race that what had occurred was that they were warning the Direct Sportives, so over race radio, about dangerous portions of the descent, and that then led to the usual sort of stampede for position, stampede to get to the front of the peloton, coming over the top of the climb. And I'm led to believe that the crashes actually happened maybe because of that, on a section that maybe wasn't one of the more dangerous bits of the descent. It, you know, there wasn't a lot of gravel further down the descent. I think there were holes and there was gravel at the side of the road.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because, you know, the information that's given to the sports directors and then passed on to the riders about what's coming up on the course, if everybody hears the same thing at the same time, then, like you say, everyone wants to be at the front to stay out of danger, which could in turn lead to making it more risky for the riders. It's a real tricky one, that, and one that I guess it's a sort of the law of unintended consequences on occasion. you know, wanting to do the best, but actually perhaps making the situation worse.
And even without the race radio warnings, chaps, we know that nowadays, particularly in a race like the Dauphiné, and you know, when there are World Tour teams competing, there's an awful lot of due diligence that goes into preparing every stage, and it's quite mind-boggling that the amount of detail actually that some teams go into. Funnily enough, I believe one of the most forensic director sportifs is Grisha Neerman, who is the Jumbo-Visma director sportif, who was at the race, and he was in the first Jumbo-Visma team car. But he's someone I know who spends hours, days studying routes, will often ask the race organisation for even more information than they've given. And yeah, he's got quite a reputation for that.
Well, let's get back to Il Lombardia then. An impressive win by Jakob Fuglsang, who 2 weekends ago looked like he was romping to victory at Strada Bianca, at least for a short period of the race. He was off the front, looking pretty strong. Obviously didn't manage to see the job home that day, but did so this weekend, got the better of George Bennett. George Bennett looked really good, I thought, and made perhaps a couple of mistakes, just two attacks within quick succession of one another, which sort of softened him. He softened himself up for Fuglsang's winning move, really. But the thing that struck me, and I know I sort of joked a little bit about it at the start, but how did Trek Segafredo manage to have three riders in the final six, two of whom are past winners of the race? Bauke Mollema is the defending champion. Vincenzo Nibali's won it twice. Giulio Ciccone is no slouch either. But when it mattered, they all went in the wrong direction. It was, it would have been interesting to be a fly on the wall in the team bus afterwards to see what was said in the debrief. Because three from six, you should get one on the podium, really, as a kind of worst-case scenario.
But, chaps, those time gaps that I mentioned earlier suggest to me that it was all decided kind of a la pedal. You know, it was the strongest guy wins, the second strongest is second, and so on and so forth, almost like a summit finish in a mountain stage.
It did look like that, and it also looked from quite early on that Fuglsang was very strong, and Bennett, we knew he was strong, and he looked strong too. I guess Trek Segafredo, if they were to reproach themselves, which I'm sure they will, They set it up for Fuglsang and Bennett and didn't at least try to put a man up the road. I thought Ciccone might be a good bet, although I don't know how he was going, obviously. It looked to me like Nibali was resigned to not winning and so was trying to do his bit for the team, but I'm not sure. You know, why not have one of them at least attack and force the others to chase? In the end, I don't think it would have made any difference, perhaps, but it was odd that they didn't appear to try that.
Do you think they were caught thinking, well, the onus as the team best represented in the break, should they have made the first move, really, or were they waiting for something else to go?
Yeah, that's the thing.
For something else to go.
They had to make the first move.
Yeah, they did, really. But they didn't.
And they didn't.
They sat and watched as everyone else did it to them. And then, Mollema was trying to get back on terms, really. And he wasn't getting an awful lot of help, was he, from Ciccone at that point, which suggests that maybe he wasn't going brilliantly.
There was one point where they seemed to be attacking each other. But Mollema also seemed to be having problems with his bike. He wasn't, there seemed to be issues there. And you know, Nibali kind of melted away pretty early on, Ciccone and Mollema made a decent fist of chasing, but you couldn't help thinking that they should have been on the front foot and tried something before anybody else did.
They should have decided to win. They should have won.
Yeah, certainly you could say, Rich, they were borderline tactics from Trek, and that Ciccone couldn't really get into the groove.
And he's no Lombardia virgin, is he? He's ridden it several times before. Oh, dear. This is terrible.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. He shares a surname with Madonna. Excellent. We've established that. But, yeah, no, not one that will go down in the Trek Segafredo annals of great race results. Fourth, fifth and sixth from a six-man group. Not great. But no, it was a good, it was a really good race though. And Daniel, a point you made a few weeks ago about this block of Italian racing, block of Italian one day racing, it has worked really well from a spectator point of view. There's been a sort of coherence to it. Strada Bianca, Milan Sanremo, Il Lombardia, you know, the kind of whole season compressed into 3 weeks with some one day races midweek. It's worked really well, and it's been good.
I wonder whether anyone's thinking about how, you know, the peloton has split down, hasn't it, into sort of stage races on the one hand and kind of classics-y riders on the other, and that will happen to a greater degree as we get to the certainly the cobbled classics as well. Maybe there's a, you know, there's somebody cleverer than me who can actually see a way to make the season work in the, on these kind of two parallel tracks, and you can have almost a sort of a stage race block after stage race block and classic blocks, and, you know, right sort of points where you can break from one block to the other block. So you could use a bit of stage racing to prepare for some classics and then hop back into more stage racing. I don't know, I'm kind of, you know, I haven't really got a point here other than to think that, other than to say that the this calendar that's been forced on us out of necessity, really, it's provided us with a lot to watch, and the storylines have been, you know, they haven't been as confused as I perhaps thought they would be. We've got a clear, you know, sense of who's heading towards the Tour and who's looking a bit beyond that, I feel.
And I wonder if that's partly what's caught Ineos out, if indeed they have been caught out. They've followed such a formula every year. This has messed up with the formula, hasn't it? Everything, you know, lockdown, the absence of races, the fact that these races don't allow as much time in between to train and regroup, and, you know, who knows? But they haven't been able to perhaps improvise as well as some other teams.
I wonder whether it will mean that the Tour de France is less predictable, raced in a slightly less predictable way than it normally would be. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly the Dauphiné had a real healthy sprinkling of anarchy, didn't it? It wasn't a controlled race, really. And certainly the last day did feel like a sort of a generation of riders all seizing their moment at more or less the same time. I mean, they've obviously got impressive results, you know, already behind them, some of them, but you know, there was no standing on ceremony, was there? I'd love to see that kind of younger generation of riders doing the same thing at the Tour, but obviously somebody like Sepkus, somebody like Pavel Sivakov, possibly not going to get the freedom at the Tour de France, or they're not going to get the freedom at the Tour de France that they've had in the past week, but maybe that will create opportunities for others.
Well, that was a fabulous day's racing at the Dauphiné, and we have had some great racing so far, and long may that sort of spirit of anarchy continue into the Tour, we hope. And this time next week, we'll be looking ahead to the Tour de France, won't we?
It will be our Tour de France preview, won't it, Daniel? From
I'll have been jettisoned. Will I not have been jettisoned by then?
No. I think we can...
Replaced? Well, that's a very strong word, Daniel.
Banished. I prefer banished.
Eased aside. No, you resume your TV role, and we bring Francois Thomazeau in as a kind of luxury substitution.
Kind of an
like having... Yeah, yeah, it's training
kind of
up.
An upgrade,
It's like having, I don't know, who's it like having on the bench? Somebody really good. But no, that'll be good. In normal circumstances, we should be talking today about stage three of the Vuelta. Can you get your head around that?
Wow.
We should be in Holland.
Is that right?
Talking about the Vuelta. Yeah. Oh.
But no, Daniel, amazing. you can take part in the Tour de France preview next week.
Oh, yes. Surely. Thanks very much. Of course.
Hopefully, you're going to make a six-part episode for Explore about your mountain biking ride. That as well, Daniel.
Or your journey to the start of the Critérium du Dauphiné.
Hacking through forests at some point tomorrow afternoon, you know, having punctured twice and run out of food and realised I haven't got a mask and, you know, thought it was now legitimate to use what shall henceforth be known as the buffalo excuse.
Anyway, listen, thank you very much, everybody who's become a friend of the Cycling Podcast. We're re-releasing Chasing Sky, which was a special episode for Friends of the Podcast about Team Jumbo-Visma, which I recorded about 18 months ago over the winter. having visited them at their training camp, it seemed relevant and appropriate to put it out again with a new intro. Lionel and I are recording a new introduction to that. That'll go out this week, I think. And hopefully explain some of where Jumbo Visma have come from. So that will be on the new feed. If you sign up as a friend of the podcast, you'll be able to listen to that. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. We really appreciate your support through that scheme, and hopefully you appreciate the special episodes that we put there. A reminder as well that our new jerseys are available. Are they available directly through our own website now, Lionel?
That's a good question. Well, you can go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on shop, and there's currently that will take you to the Katusha website, but you at some point you'll also be able to just buy directly from us, and we'll be posting them out as well. So there'll be multiple ways to get the jersey from the website.
Indeed. Well, before we go this week, some thank yous to friends of the podcast. From me, a big thanks to Jason Humphreys, Alan Owens, Greg Reineler, I hope I've said that right, Greg, Mark Drinnen, Gary McAleese, and Fred Grimm.
And thank you to Richie Grant, David Clark, James Dapper, Alan Thompson, Matt Burns, Panu Pokila, I hope that's right, Simon Lund, and Ian Hembo. Simon Lund, our friend Simon Lund, who very kindly allowed us to stay in his house in the Alps 2 years running. Hello,
two
Simon.
Years. Hello, Simon.
And thanks from me to John Pocock, Tom Bowker, Patrick Mackay, Ian Forfer, Martin Taylor, and Stephen Banville.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.